Santa Cruz is home to such a rich surf history, and I feel like much of the story hasn't really been told. We are all aware of the characters, but I feel like sometimes the media is focused on some of the more sensational of the characters or illicit storylines that's really done a disservice to us, the general fans or surfing public, who are just interested to hear the real basic historical timelines and facts about who, what, when, and where.
Yeah, I think it's such a beautifully visual area, Santa Cruz. It just really nice ways, you know, and just the geography of the coastline and the land. And
right.
So I think people get pretty passionate about, you know, capturing that moment. And so I guess that has a lot to do with how Santa Cruz has been influential with surfing in the media just over the years. It's been pretty prominently featured.
So I was talking with my friend, the surf photographer and filmmaker Tony Roberts. His episode is number 25 of Surf Splendor. Make sure to check that out in the archives if you have not already. And anyways, Tony was raised in Santa Cruz, and he documented a lot of the surf and skate movement in the 80s and 90s through a series of films, which you've very likely seen. And we were trying to develop a plan for how it might be best to share the stories of Santa Cruz, perhaps some that haven't yet been told. Tony had a lot of ideas, he had a lot of names, but he said that the one guy that I should start with is Richard Schmidt. He said there are plenty of people that came before Richard, but Richard's a great starting point because he is universally respected and loved within the community, as well as through the Hawaiian surfing community. So that's where I'll begin, with Tony's advice. This might be a good time to give you a short bio on Richard, but I know you came here for the full-length bio, so I will let Richard do the talking. My name is David Scales, and big wave icon and Santa Cruz legend Richard Schmidt is the subject of today's episode of Surf Splendor. Enjoy. We recorded this interview at Richard's kitchen table in his home in Santa Cruz, mere steps away from the ocean.
Yeah, so I guess I started surfing about 1968.
Okay.
I was 8 years old, and we would go down to the river mouth beach right in front of the boardwalk. And back then, a lot of people were riding inflatable mats. It was like before boogie boards, so a lot of belly boarding on these inflatable mats. And it's crazy. There'd be like, you know, 40 people on inflatable mats out there just riding the closeouts or
like
riding
moms
up the
and
river.
Dads and stuff and everything.
Well, oh, yeah. Families, moms and dads. And so that's where I got my love for the ocean. My parents loved to go to the beach. And I had three brothers. So we started playing out there. And we also, in addition to the mats, we'd get these styrofoam boards, those little styrofoam boards, and ride them as well. I used to stand up on those things when I was like 8 years old. And then me and my brothers talked our parents into buying a longboard from this guy Otto. There's this guy Otto that had a surf shop right at the base of the wharf. Mm. And he had all these classic old longboards. And we bought a board from him and then shared it and rode off the point at Cowles Cove.
Yeah.
Really a great way for learning. And this kind of went from there, yeah.
Who were the guys around that time? Like, who were the key figures that were surfing?
Back then, the good guys, I mean, Joey Thomas has always been one of the best surfers here in Santa Cruz, and he was definitely one of the standouts way back then. Greg Bonner, John Arnold, really good tube rider, Michelle Janone. Doug Hout was, you know, has been around forever in Santa Cruz and building boards in the late 60s, as well as Joey Thomas, you know, John Mill.
Yeah, I heard, I don't know, years ago, that it's like there's a higher number of shapers per capita in Santa Cruz than any other surf region in the world. Like more shapers per surfer than
yeah.
anywhere else, you know?
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. A lot of people are real craftsmen. And
right.
I don't know what it is, but yeah, it's pretty infectious, you know, the whole surfing environment. And Santa Cruz because it's really visual. You know, it's all the surf spots are like amphitheaters because there's cliffs that look down right. to them. And so people look out at it and just go, wow, I like to do that. And the people that are surfers are always just checking the waves. And yeah, it's just kind of infiltrating in the whole community.
One important detail for the surfing world is that the wetsuit for the purpose of surfing was brought to popularity in Santa Cruz by Jack O'Neill. It was invented in 1951 by a physicist, and Jack began experimenting with it in San Francisco in 52. And eventually, he opened his second surf shop in Santa Cruz in 1959, just in time for the big surf culture boom. Bob and Bill Maestrel of Body Glove were following kind of a simultaneous path in Manhattan Beach, just to keep the record straight.
There were wetsuits back then. I definitely started without a wetsuit, and I'll just never forget my 12th birthday. Went to Portola Surf Shop and bought a Primo full-length wetsuit. Oh, it was just like heaven, man. We had a barbecue down on the beach at Cowles. We roasted hot dogs. I got to surf in a wetsuit, and I was warm. And
yeah.
Just an incredible experience.
What brand wetsuit was that?
Primo. Primo. Yeah, okay. Primo wetsuits from okay. Mike Locatelli. He owned a surf shop, Portola Surf Shop.
Among those surfers that you mentioned, was there any professional surfing at that point? Like, was that even a potential goal for a young guy coming up?
You know, in the early 70s, not much. You know, mid-70s, yeah, there was a couple of pro contests that came to town. Remember the South Africans came, went for a team challenge or something like in the mid-70s. And, Yeah, Joey Thomas did really well. I think he got second place.
Okay.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot. It was just kind of getting started, that whole professional surfing scene, mid-70s, it seemed like.
Was there any ambition to, like, go travel and surf outside of Santa Cruz? Or I mean, I guess what my question is, like, how do you finance that sort of a thing? And if professional surfing isn't an option, you just work for a period of time, save up money, and go on trips? Or
yeah, that was kind of what we did. You know, I would work summers as a lifeguard and a sales rep and make some money, and then just spend the rest of the year doing, you know, going to Hawaii mostly, but also traveling. And
yeah.
Santa Cruz is such a great place to surf, but you know, with the wetsuit on year round, you have a lot of people wanting to get out of Santa Cruz and go somewhere where they could take their wetsuit off. And so you hear these warm climates and nice waves. And so you do have people from Santa Cruz traveling all over the world just because you just get sick of wearing a wetsuit all the time. So yeah we heard of a place, Puerto Escondido, when I was turning 18. That was pretty incredible to go down there.
In 1980, Surfing Magazine published a series of photos of Richard surfing scary, big Puerto Escondido, shot by Santa Cruz photographer Chris Clough. It was rumored to be the Mexican pipeline, but this was the first time the surfing public laid eyes on this fabled wave. Richard ventured down south with Clough and another Santa Cruz surfer, Vince Collier.
Clough found out about it. Chris Clough found out about it somehow, and said, "I know this spot." He starts frothing, and we got to get down there. And I had already gone to a semester of college, and I was going to go to another one. And I just got persuaded, you know, just go on the surf trip with us. Yeah, I'm kind of glad I did. It was pretty amazing experience. You know, down there for a month, and I mean, I just went back there this last summer and really was reflecting on how it used to be down there. It's crazy how it's been built up over the years. They actually have hotels on the beach and stuff.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, that trip in 1980, when those photos got published, had photos been published in the surf mags of Puerto before, or was that kind of its first?
It might have been one of its first.
I feel like it was.
I don't remember seeing any photos of that place. It seemed like I would say, oh, man, look at those waves. I'd like to go surf there. So I don't think that could have been one of the first trips where the photos were published.
Were there other guys surfing down there when you went?
Yeah, there was a lot of kind of older expats, you know,
And
guys that are kind of hanging out that liked it. And Yeah, we just arrived on the scene. Me and Vince just pushing each other, just pulling these big closeout barrels to get barrel. They're just shaking their heads, going, "Oh, these guys are going to die out here," you know. But that was just when we initially first got off the plane. We were just gun ho, you know. And we got more selective, but it got really good on that trip. Big A frames.
Did you have an interest in big wave surfing prior to that trip?
Yeah, just growing up in Santa Cruz, the conditions are pretty raw and pretty powerful, and so you just kind of gravitate towards that, you know. And then when you get in a situation where the waves are big and powerful and warm, it just, you know, makes it that much easier for you, having grown up in a wetsuit. So
feels more forgiving.
More forgiving. So that definitely inspired big wave thing a little bit that trip.
Yeah.
In Puerto. And so the following winter I went to Hawaii and ended up going there for 16 years every year.
Hawaii has always been a mecca for the surfer, especially those interested in big wave riding. However, while now time in Hawaii is a requisite for professional surfers looking to establish their career, back then, Hawaii was simply the end goal. If you were lucky enough to secure a paycheck through surfing, it was simply a means to finance a winter in Hawaii. There was nothing more.
Just incredible how, you know, you'll be there and you'll not ride anything shorter than like a 7.4 for like a month straight. You know, just the energy that's just coming at you on a daily basis is just incredible. Just really inspiring and challenging. And Greg Bonner and John Arnold kind of took us under their wing a little bit, showed us around. And I'll never forget surfing Sunset Beach with Greg Bonner.
Yeah.
And he just was paddling out and halfway up the face just spun around and just whipped it on like about a 10-foot west peak. Way like, wow, that's how you do it, huh?
Wow.
Incredible surf for that guy.
Whose boards were you riding at that time? Were you bringing boards from Santa Cruz with you?
Yeah, Doug Hout. Doug Hout used to help me out with my equipment back then. He made me a nice quiver for Puerto, which worked out really well. You know, a 7.4 and a 6.6 single fins just worked out great. And then he made me a couple boards for Hawaii as well, which worked out well.
I try to put myself in that headspace because nowadays you forecast swells, you know exactly what the waves are going to be like, so you can get a quiver made for that specific wave. At that time, I'm wondering, Puerto, you really didn't know what to expect, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we heard it was kind of like pipeline, so, you know, nice, meaty, kind of knifey, pintail, single fin.
Yeah.
Something similar to what they were riding at Pipeline back in those days. Sure. Is what we kind of went off of.
Sure. A lot more duck diving, though.
Yeah, a lot more duck diving than Pipeline, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So you obviously, like you said, spent a lot of time in Hawaii and established kind of a reputation as a big wave surfer.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how it happened. Just spending, you know, like 16 winters over there, you know, 3 to 6 months a year. And just in Hawaii, you just ride big waves. If you're just living on the North Shore, the big waves just keep coming. So you either ride them or you sit on the beach and watch them. So it's just kind of a thing that just transpired. And a lot of people, though, when it got a certain size, they kind of just didn't go out, you
disappear.
Know. But it's pretty hard not to go out when it's offshore and sunny and just big, beautiful lines. And yeah, like in the early 80s, Waimea was just going off, and it really wasn't that crowd. Not too much attention was going on towards there. So I guess being a guy from California that was out there consistently, I kind of got a little bit of attention and got a reputation as a guy that would go when the waves got big.
You ended up being invited to the Eddy. Tell me about that experience.
Oh, yeah, that was just amazing to be part of that for so many years. I guess it was our second or third one, like the 89-90 season. They had that real epic Eddie Aikau contest where it was like 25, 30 feet and just perfect. And Brock Little got a big barrel. Mm-hmm. And Keone ended up winning it that year. But that was still to this day the pinnacle of my surfing career, was surfing those waves with that crew of guys. You know, 24 guys that were just amazing surfers, and really not that many big wipeouts, you know, just really just respectful toward the wave and just the waves that I saw that day and witnessed and rode. Just an amazing experience. So I ended up getting third in the contest, and it was just really a cool thing to be a part of, and just the whole reverence towards Eddie, you know, right. and the ceremony and the Hawaiian culture and how I was accepted and brought into that whole thing was pretty special. And then after that contest, I did really well. And then wasn't held for about 8-10 years after that.
Yeah.
But it was a good excuse to go to the North Shore and train and surf every day. And, oh, yeah, I'm on hold for this contest. And mm-hmm. I enjoyed just being a part of that. And it gave me kind of a legitimacy to be hanging out on the North Shore surfing every day. It was pretty cool.
Were you the first Californian to be invited to the Eddie?
Possibly, yeah. I think so.
I haven't seen that written anywhere. I was just trying to think of another Californian who might have been.
I think I got a poster in my room that has all the...
all the invitees.
Yeah. There's another guy I forgot. Marty Hoffman.
Oh, okay.
Marty Hoffman was also part of that crew, and he's from California. Okay. Well, kind of the North Shore, though, too, though. Flippy.
Did he surf in the event, though, or was he just invited? And
yeah, no, I think he surfed, too. Yeah, okay. Marty surfed in it, too.
Okay.
I mean, he is from California, but I think he's kind of like from Hawaii, too, you know, because his father was... He spent a lot of time there.
Sure. Do you follow... currently professional big wave surfing at all, like the Big Wave World Tour?
Yeah, I really enjoy kind of checking out, seeing what's going on and when the contests are and all that. Yeah, it's fun.
I'm curious about your thoughts on it because, like, I try to follow it and I feel it's not really so geared for the spectator, I guess. Like with the other WCT events, like the one at Margaret River right now, they run it over, you know, a week-long period of time. There's a lot of pre-hype that leads up to it, so you get excited. There's all this production value, and it's a good spectator sport. The big wave thing, I feel like sometimes it just happens, and then you see the news like, oh, Makua Rothman won whatever event it was yesterday.
Yeah.
What are the challenges, do you think, that they're, you know, that face profession, trying to make it competitive and trying to make it professional?
The most challenging thing is conditions, because it's such a rare event where the waves get worthy of a big wave contest. I mean, they set the standards really high, and you can't just pick a date. We're going to do it on this waiting period. The waiting periods are like 3 months long, which is just exactly. ridiculous. You know, like the Eddie Aikawa I used to wait for every year. It was 3 months long. It's just...
And you wait, like you said, 9 years sometimes.
9 years and 3 months every year. Oh, exactly. I got burned out. I mean, I just 1 year I'm done, you know. It's like I was still invited. I just kind of said I'm over it. I just can't live in limbo. You're basically living in limbo, right. waiting for that next swell. You know, and a lot of times it doesn't happen in 8-9 years, but you know how many swells that were potential swells that could have happened? It just drives you crazy. Like, oh yeah, it's on the chart, so you're watching it and it doesn't happen. And you fly over and then it peaked out during the night and it doesn't happen. Right. It's really the challenge is to, you can't really put in a package and market it for a specific date because it, you know, it's just such a long waiting period. It'd be nice if they could just focus on 2 or 3 weeks, you know, but then it won't happen because it's so rare. So I guess you got to have the long waiting period, but yeah, hard to market it to the masses when it's just so rare.
Is there a better way to do it, do you think?
I think they might do it a little better if they just lower the standards a little bit. Like this year, there were some chances they could have had the contest at Jaws, and they just, it's like the standard was so high, like, oh, no, we're just going to wait. And if they could just try to have more of the contest, even though it's not like, you know, epic, just, you know, just to get the guys out there and competing and get some exposure in the media, be better.
I guess... Like, I'm a big fan, and I want to watch it. But even for me, who's fully committed, it's disappointing when at the end of the year they ran 3 out of 6 events or 2 out of 6 events or whatever it is. It's disheartening as a fan, you know?
Yeah, I think if there's any way they could, you know, run all 6 events. But I guess that could also backfire, too, because then if you held them in subpar conditions, then it's not going to be as dramatic, and you're going to lose... Yeah. Bands that way too. So it's challenging.
I was wondering about a format that may be more similar to like the XXL awards where there's not necessarily judges on the spot, but we see these big wave sessions take place throughout the year. And then what if they just kind of green light it like, hey, there's a swell coming to Jaws or Mavericks. we're giving you guys a green light during these this swell. Any photos and video that you submit will go into the running for the Big Wave World Tour, you know?
That would be kind of cool. I said, okay, this is the swell, and it's going to be judged during these 2 days. And it'll be documented.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, people will be filming, and at the end there'll be a panel that can go through all the stuff. Yeah. And
we're not sending our filmers, but if you get documentation and you send it to us, we'll put it in the running.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that might make it a little more easier to handle, you know.
And then they could package it and sell it to us, the consumer. Just, I'd be more interested to watch that than sitting in front of my computer for 8 hours waiting for sets to roll in.
Yeah.
You know, and,
yeah, that's a good idea. I think that would be a good idea, actually.
It just seems like there's, I don't know, there's kind of a, I don't know, a blend of the two models, the Big Wave World Tour and the W or the XXL thing. By the way, Puerto's added to the Big Wave World Tour this year.
Oh, I heard about that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's they might have a good chance of running the event there
because
it's very a consistent spot. And even when it's like, you know, 12 feet, you know, 14, you know, it doesn't have to be 20 feet. It's going to be pretty dramatic. You know, that way it's pretty dramatic when it's 10, 12 feet.
Totally.
Too. So, yeah, that'd be cool if they were able to pull that.
I think it adds some of that amphitheater experience that you're talking about with Santa Cruz where – like Jaws breaks out in the middle and Mavericks breaks out in the middle of, you know, not the middle, but far out. This, it's like you can stand on the beach and watch it. It's also, it's not a reef break, you know, so that adds in a different element. It's only a barrel, essentially. You know, these other waves barrel, but you can get a drop and get a 10 at Jaws.
Yeah.
This, it's like if you just make the drop and don't get barreled, you're not getting the score.
Yeah, that's a great, very exciting venue. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool.
How is it different in terms of, I don't know, fear level or skill level surfing somewhere like Puerto versus Waimea?
You know, you got to have a lot of knowledge and a lot of luck sometimes just to catch a wave because it shifts around a lot. Waimea is pretty specific. The wave comes in right in that one spot.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to really know your lineups to be right there. But Puerto has a set of hazards that's a little different. Just, you know, there's no channel to paddle out in. And it shifts around. And, oh, man, getting caught inside out there is pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
We got it so big 1 year. There was so much water moving. This guy was paddling out. And he hits it. His board hits a chop. And the current takes his board. And his board disappears for like 6 seconds. There's so much water. Grabbed it, pulled underwater, and popped up about 20 feet away.
While he was just paddling.
That's how much water is moving out there. It's a really crazy, dynamic place. You know, the rips, currents out there, the water move. I've never seen anything like it anywhere.
Really?
Yeah, so it's definitely more of a waterman kind of a thing. But boy, the girth of a wave like Waimea, there's just so much water in the wave. That, man, when you wipe out on that wave, when you're in the bowl, it's you get thrashed.
Sure.
And more roll towards shore rather than Puerto's kind of up and down. You just get thrashed and you pop back up. Whereas Waimea just kind of take you for a ride, you know, 100 yards down the point.
While Richard had been chasing huge surf in Mexico and Hawaii, little did he know that one of the world's heaviest and best big waves, Mavericks, had been looming in his own backyard, a mere 60 minutes north in Half Moon Bay.
That same contest I rode, the Iacal 8990, was just a, you know, once every 10-year kind of a swell, and it was just huge, big, perfect lines. And
so was it the same swell that hit Waimea that was then coming to California?
Yeah, that same swell was hitting California. And my brother Dave ran into Jeff Clark the next day. I mean, I surfed these huge waves at the Eddy, and I called my brother that night. It was just frothing on what a day I just had and how good the waves were. And then he called me the next night and was like equally as frothy, if not more, about this place that he had surfed that day. He ran into Jeff up at Ocean Beach, and it was just kind of big and perfect, but really hard to get out. And so Jeff goes, I'll take you to a spot that's breaking, but there's a channel you can make it out. So they went down there on that swell, and So anyway, my brother said, you got to get down here. You got to bring your big wave board home this year, because there's a spot that's, you could fit semi trucks inside the barrels. It's just like incredible. So that spring, I went back up there with him and some friends and Jeff, and thank God I brought my Waimea board back, because it was really similar to what Waimea offers, just deep water and onto a boil and big, huge faces. And so, yeah, for a couple of years, we would just surf it, just kind of checking it out. You know, Vince Collier, my brother Dave, Tom Powers, and a crew of Santa Cruz guys, and it just slowly got recognition and became a thing where people wanted to travel from Hawaii and stuff to surf the spot.
Yeah. When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
When your brother surfed it with Jeff that day you were in Hawaii, how long had Jeff been surfing it prior to inviting your brother?
I heard like 15 years or something. He'd been surfing it on his own.
That's so insane. And,
yeah, incredible, you know, to be out there alone. That place is scary. I guess he used to ride the lefts, you know, he used to paddle out around the lefts and catch the lefts.
Why did he wait that long to introduce it to somebody? And then also, why do you think he finally decided to invite your brother?
He tried to introduce it to a lot of people over the years. Oh, okay. There's a lot of his friends just didn't want anything to do with it. They would look at it and kind of know, yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Wow.
No thanks. But maybe my brother and Tom Powers actually was with my brother, and they were the first guys he introduced to that really wanted a piece of it. They went out there and they got some good waves. And then, of course, Santa Cruz is such a huge epicenter of surfing energy that, you know, other people from Santa Cruz like myself and Vince Collier were like, wow, this is something special. Let's pursue this. You know, this is like Mount Everest right here in our backyard. And
it's fascinating, though, that it could remain a secret for that long.
Yeah.
If for nothing else other than the spectacle. Like, I would think you and your buddies would have gone up there as kids and just watched it, you know?
Yeah, well, it was kind of like a myth, kind of like a lore. My friend used to fish out of Half Moon Bay, and he said, man, when you go out that channel in the winter, there's this wave out there that was just so heavy.
Yeah.
I used to hear stories about it, you know?
Oh, okay.
But I never really went out and checked it myself. So there was kind of this myth about a wave that broke up there for a lot of years. But no one really took the time out to really check it out.
Where does the name come from?
I guess it was the name of a dog. Mavericks was a dog. And there used to be a guy that maybe went out there and surfed the inside break, you know, and ended up calling it Mavericks.
It was his dog.
Yeah, Mavericks, yeah.
Interesting. What makes Mavericks unique from other big wave spots?
It's just, it grows so much when it comes out. The groundswell, when it's coming out of the deep water, doesn't really look that big. And then when it hits the boil, it grows exponentially. I mean, I've never seen a wave grow that much bigger. You see it and it's coming, it looks pretty big, and all of a sudden it hits the reef and it just you know, grossed. It just jacks up so hard and so dramatically.
Like instantly, within the matter of 5 seconds?
Yeah, it's, you know, almost every takeoff out there is late. Sometimes you can get a roll in, you know, it's a little lumpy, you can catch a lump, but when it's really clean, ruler edge, man, it hits that reef and it grows so dramatically, so fast that your timing and everything's got to be so perfect. It's the most challenging wave I've ever ridden, the most horrendous.
And is it?
So much power in that way. When you fall out there, man, you just get thrashed. And then you got the rocks, you know, and I guess there's supposed to be sharks out there too. I never seen one, but just the whole vibe of the place is just so heavy in the wave itself, just so challenging. I think it's the heaviest wave in the world.
Is it?
I don't know. I haven't traveled the world, but from what I've experienced, yeah, it's on another scale than anything else I've ever surfed.
I'm glad you said that, because just at strictly as a spectator, it's very difficult to define the nuance of difference between that and Dungeons or Waimea or whatever else. You know, they all look big and scary to me.
Yeah. No, it's and it's also the topography of the bottom too, which makes it so hairy, because it gets really shallow. And then it gets deep. And so if you get washed over that shallow spot, it's like a waterfall going into that deeper cavern. Because it's shallow, deep, shallow, deep. It's kind of like steps.
Have you been in a position where you've gotten washed over? Or do you hit the bottom and physically feel the wash over?
You can. I never have. I've talked to people. But I just know that the topography, that
sure,
that's why people end up getting stuff down there for two waves and stuff. Because it's shallow and it goes deep.
Yeah.
So it rushes over the shallow and then just falls over the deep spot.
Mm-hmm.
So it just throws you really, really deep. So that's part of it that makes it so sketchy.
What's your opinion on the current kind of, I don't know, politics of Mavericks or the situation, how it's gotten more crowded over the years? And I know events have run there successfully at times. I think you got second place at the Mavericks event, right? When it was the Quicksilver?
Yeah, the very first event I got second, yeah.
It was the very first one?
Yeah.
Okay. Who did Flea win?
Yeah, Flea won that one, yeah.
What are your opinions about the politics of Mavericks?
Oh, it's kind of sad, because there are a lot of different people trying to make it work. I mean, it's such a spectacle. It should be packaged and brought to the world where people can really appreciate the wave itself. And, you know, it should just be a celebration of the athletes and the wave itself. But I don't know. I don't really like to have an elimination format on a wave that's that intense.
Mm.
I don't really like the Yeti iCal format, where you surf twice like you would on a normal day. And then they just take your top scores and call a winner, rather than surfing and having a timeline where you got to catch your waves, and then there's elimination. So you're out there and guys with your heat and you're surfing against them, because if they get a good wave, you're going to get knocked out. Whereas the other format, you're cheering the guys on. And so it's kind of getting, people are getting turned into gladiators a little bit, you know. But on the other hand, you know, it makes for a better contest as far as pushing someone's physical level to the maximum. And for the spectator, it's great, you know, because people are pushing themselves where they normally wouldn't be. But, a lot of people really want to make it work and make it happen. And I think it's good. There's a lot of good people involved right now.
Are there?
Yeah, there are. Yeah, there's a lot of, like Daryl Flevarosco is on the board, and Cartel Management, this new has taken it over. It's a new organizer for the event, and they really have grand visions to make it happen. And, you know, so I think it's going to happen, and hopefully it'll be packaged and marketed, and the athletes will get rewarded, which they deserve, you know, for the future years to come. And
it seems like Cartel Management ran into a few hiccups this year, though, right? I mean, like,
yeah,
I heard there was a little squabble with a couple of the photographers in terms of just day rate. And then even, like, Pete Mel didn't get the invite, which I think was pretty controversial, you know? So what's... What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think they could have maybe made some better decisions.
What was behind that? Those decisions?
Well, I'm not really that up to date on all that stuff. I'm just like yourself. I've just kind of heard this and I've heard that, and I'm not really part of the committee that decides these things. But I guess Peter Mell is part of the World Surf League, and he runs the World Surf League, and so the organizer of the contest thinks it's a conflict, or somebody thinks it's a conflict of interest. Like, I don't know why, but yeah, that's kind of lame. Peter Mell should be in that.
He's a past
event.
Winner.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. So it's just really too bad that there's controversy surrounding that, because it is a great event, and the athletes that are out there all the time deserve to be rewarded and have a venue where they could display their surfing. And
I think the way it looks from the outside is the last thing that you want is for some governing body with their eyes on dollar signs come in and pervert, you know, what we love and believe is pure. You know, that's the worst case scenario.
Sure.
And so I'm not saying that is what's happening. It's just that when these little decisions get made along the way, that becomes your concern.
Yeah, it'd be nice, because it's a really great event. People love watching that. I mean, man versus the ocean. It is like Mount Everest of mm-hmm. the ocean, that wave. And it's kind of sad that there is controversy surrounding that, because it'll get worked out. I think it's just some growing pains with the event.
Okay. Yeah, because you started out by saying you think that it is the right people in place.
Yeah, so. Yeah. There are some really great people that are working together to make it the event that it could be. So yeah. I have high hopes for that event.
Good. Good. Who among that scene? I know, like, Mavericks obviously has gotten a lot more crowded over the years. And I guess even one of the big swells leading up to this season was, like, stand-up paddlers out there and everything. Who among that crew currently are the standouts, do you think?
I haven't been surfing up there for quite a few years, so okay. I really can't say. I'm just like you. I'll see some photos and some videos, and, you know, I talk to people and I hear what people have to say. But I guess Garrett McNamara did really well in that one big day. And who's the other guy that got an invite? Oh, what was the guy's
name? Jamie Mitchell, maybe?
Yeah, Jamie Mitchell, I guess, was just going above and beyond.
Yeah.
Just pushing himself, because there was one really standout day this year, and
yeah, exactly.
And I guess it separated the guys who really wanted it and who wasn't true. But I don't know. I kind of I had mixed feelings about that too. It's like Shane Dorian didn't get a wave, or maybe got one wave, and Mark Healy maybe didn't get a wave. And you know, I respect that. If they're out there and if they're not in the right spot and they're not going to just go, you know, just for their reputation or whatever, that they have that much respect for the way that if they're not in the right spot, it's not worth, you know, it's not worth risking. So mm-hmm. you got to respect that too. On the other hand, you know, you see a guy like Jamie Mitchell would just go on regardless. He didn't care about his health. You know, it's like, that's great and all that, but I don't know, you know. I respect the other end of the spectrum too, where people respect the wave and they're not going to just risk it just for the photo or whatever else, you know.
Or because they bought a plane ticket and they made all this arrangement to get here. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not how that's, you know, that's waves on a different scale. You can't just throw yourself over the ledge and you could pay a big price out there. It's crazy how dangerous that wave is.
In 1979, Richard launched a surf school in Santa Cruz. It grew out of an organic desire within the community. The local non-surfers wanted to participate in this activity that draws tourists from around the world to their local beaches. Richard's reputation as a surfer made him an authority, but his calm and patient demeanor is what's made his school a success for the past 36 years.
Yeah, I started teaching in 1978 when I was 18 years old. I'm 54 now, so it's been quite a long journey of sharing.
I can't think of another surf school that's run that long.
1978, that's crazy, huh?
Is there anyone that you know of?
I'm not really sure. Maybe not, yeah.
It's like the most prominent surf school that I know of, for sure.
Yeah, just I was lifeguarding, and a friend of mine, Calvin Holm, he had a local class with the local Parks and Rec, and he goes, you want to teach it, you know, because he knew how into surfing I was. I go, yeah, sure, you know. And so I started teaching for the local Parks and Rec, and it's just grown into more and more lessons as people call me outside of the Parks and Rec. And so I do a lot of lessons, and then I started to do overnight surf camps in 1990. So it'll be 25 years this summer that we have this program where kids come, the parents drop them off, we have them for 5 days, and we feed them and transport them and teach them yoga and film them every day surfing, get into their mechanics and push their surfing ability to the next level, whether they're just beginning or maybe they're good surfers, they want to, you know, learn how to do a floater or whatever. And then we started going to Costa Rica in 2000. So it's been about 14 years of going down there, just 1 month a year, you know, doing week-long programs down there. That's been really, really cool to be able to go somewhere warm and share a nice place with people.
And people fly in to participate in that?
Yeah, people fly down there. They do their travel arrangements on their own and just kind of hook up with us. And another note, like when we started doing our surf camps in 1990, you know, the first year we were doing yoga combined with the surf camps, and just saw it as really complementary to surfing. And now it's gotten more mainstream, like yoga, yeah, surf camps. So I look back and I go, wow, we were kind of the first guys to kind of incorporate that into our programs as well. So that's a big part of it, you know, just being aware of your body, eating well. You know, my wife's really helped out with doing the yoga and the diet. And so it's a really intensive, good way to improve your surfing skills.
So what what level of surfers do you cater to with the surf school?
When I do my lessons, I would say a lot of beginners. But I coach other kids that are more advanced and all that kind of stuff. We do the whole spectrum. But in our lessons, definitely more novices. And then the surf camps, we get novices, but we get a lot of people who return for years and years and years. And more advanced, where they want to kind of push their skill to the next level. But a lot of novices with that too.
What about what age groups do you cater to?
During the summer here in Santa Cruz, we do 6 weeks. 2 of those weeks are adults, and then 4 of the weeks are kids. And the average age is between 12 and 15, but we take kids as young as 10, and we get older kids as well with those programs. But it's really a great experience, you know, especially for kids that don't have the opportunity to get to the beach too often, just to be on the beach for a week and in the water every day. And it's such a beautiful place as Santa Cruz, you know, it's a world surfing reserve because the variety of surf breaks we have here, maybe like 4 or 5 places in the whole world have been declared a world surfing reserve. And then on top of that, it's a national marine sanctuary. So this, the wildlife that you see when you're out there surfing on a daily basis is just incredible. So to have a place like this to run a program like a surf camp has just been incredible.
Yeah.
I've really learned a lot teaching over the years, doing it for so long. I'm still learning new techniques to relate information to students. So I train them, and I'm pretty confident in the staff I have.
Cool. You provide the boards?
Yeah, boards and wetsuits. Yeah.
Cool. You mentioned lifeguarding at some point. How long were you lifeguarding?
I was a lifeguard for 15 years.
Oh, you were? Okay.
Yeah, for the city of Santa Cruz on the beach there. And that's when I started teaching surfing. And then that kind of took over where I got more into that rather than lifeguarding, because just the demand, people just kept calling and wanted to go surfing. And the waves here in Santa Cruz are just so beautiful to share with people.
Mm.
Just perfect ways for learning. I mean, this place I teach, Cowles Cove, it's like, I could take people out and they've never surfed before, and I could get them up and surf with them next to them, put them in the curl of the wave, and they could surf like, you know, 40, 50 yards in the curl of the wave their first go out. And
no
just the stoke I see on people's faces over the years has just been invaluable. It just kind of rubs off on you, you know, positive energy and vibe. Just, it's infectious, and just be able to be part of that for so many years has been incredible.
Well, I think it's a shame to admit, but there's times where I will go surfing and exit the water in a worse mood than I entered, just because I'm thinking about work and then the waves are kind of crappy, so my heart's not really in it, but I just go, and then I'm trying too hard to rip, and then I don't, you know, it's embarrassing that it's gotten to that, you know? So what you're talking about is like a good reminder.
Yeah. When you see that fresh stoke, you know, people can be so stoked on just, for me, it's just being in the water too, you know, like you say, sometimes you just go, you know, and the ocean is very therapeutic, as long as you don't, you know, we all have high standards for ourselves as far as performing out in the water. You want to, you know, put it together, but it is really difficult to really put it all together in the water all the time. And
yeah,
you just have to laugh at yourself and just realize how hard it is and how special it is when you do go out there and put together a good session. But when you don't, yeah, you can't be coming and kicking the sand. You really got to be appreciative that you're healthy enough.
Totally.
And you're still here breathing in this world, that you're out there playing in the ocean. It's just pretty much a blessing.
One of the best things that I've seen that illustrated that recently was that new video. I don't know if you saw it, Kyle Boothman made about Anthony Tashnik.
Oh, the kids were watching it a couple of days. I haven't had a chance to watch it.
It's beautiful. It's so cool. Beautifully made.
Cool.
Like, Kyle did a phenomenal job with it, but Tashnik, like, illustrates exactly what we're talking about. He takes a soft top out on nothing waves, like ankle high waves I wouldn't even look twice at, and like a Pearson Arrow gun. I think he might have taken the fins out of it, but just rides that, you know, on these ankle high waves in these perfectly sunny and beautiful day, that he's getting the most out of it. He's getting more out of that day than anybody else would have, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, and he talks all about exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, you got to have that attitude, you know, because it is sad when you get to the point where you come in pissed off because you didn't get there. You fell in your best wave
or yeah,
whatever. Yeah, you got to put it in perspective. That's totally what teaching yeah can help you with, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, being, like you said, it rubs off on you.
Yeah.
So you've been around for... you know, you've seen a lot in the years that you've been around. What has changed the most about Santa Cruz and the surf scene here, and what has remained exactly the same over those years?
The core crew of individuals that, you know, grow up close to the waves and surf out there all the time, you know, the faces have changed, but that's kind of stayed the same, you know. Well, a little bit. It used to be a little more territorial, maybe, you know, and there's definitely been waves of change in different outlooks. And, you know, sometime the core crew would be pretty heavy partiers, and now it seems like the young kids that are growing up are just really respectful and knowing that, you know, partying hard is not cool. You know, you got to have your life together and your act together, and surfing is your recreation. And so it's a little less hardcore now, which is wonderful, man. The crew of kids that are growing up just really have bright outlooks, and they get along pretty well. And
seems like Nat Young's been a good ambassador.
Oh, man, yeah. He's just a respectful kid, happy-go-lucky,
Yeah. Not
the hard partier. He's disciplined, he trains, and more of an athlete, you know. So I think the individuals are more respectable and more together, you know, because there has been eras over the years where people took more into partying and just being rebels and that kind of a thing with surfing. So I think surfers are getting a little more respect as a result, you know, mm-hmm. rather than being on the outcast of society. They're fully mainstream here, you know, probably all over the world too. But, you know, there's just so many doctors and teachers or whatever, a lot of professional people that surf, and the kids aren't delinquents, you know, that are surfing to get away from school or whatever else. They're just, you know, kids having fun. And,
yeah.
And of course, it's gotten more crowded over the years, but, you know, we're just blessed that you can go north of Santa Cruz or south of Santa Cruz, get out of the city limits. There's so many ways.
Yeah.
Especially on a day like today, you know, it's all clean today. You can mm-hmm. go north or south, and
plenty of swell.
But they're definitely, it's gotten more urbanized.
Sure. What's your current relationship like with surfing? How often do you surf?
As much as I can. I still get in the water pretty much every day. If I'm not teaching, I'm surfing. And like today, the waves are pumping, and I don't have to do any lessons today. I mean, I love to do lessons, but sometimes it kind of zaps all your energy when the waves are good. So my body's going to be fresh, and I just feel like a kid, you know. No, it's good. Waves are going to be good, and I got time to go play myself. It's just surfing's... I still got that passion for it. It just, some people quit surfing. I can't see how, you know. It's just, I love getting out there and the challenge, you know, that you have to try to put it all together. I love it.
Good. Final question for everybody interviewed. What was the last surfboard that you rode?
The last surfboard I rode? Joey Thomas has been making my boards for like 30 years. And We used to ride the four fin boards that everybody's riding now, like 35 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, just round pins, swallowtail, four fins. I just thrusters were never my thing. Well, we had twin fins there for a while, but got really into four fins. And then Will Jobson came out with the Twinser setup where we put the power fin in the back and the smaller fin in the front. And I switched over to that, and I've been riding that for the last 20 years. And I don't know, I kind of like the power fin in the back rather than the bigger fin forward with the trailing fin in the back that most people ride. But
What about it? What's the unique characteristic about it?
It's just more rail to rail, and it's a little, it carries its speed. You don't have to pump so hard to get your speed. Like on a thruster, you got to really just keep pushing it the whole time to keep it going. But you get a little more glide. You could fly out on the flat spots. In Santa Cruz, you have some flat spots in between sections. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of glide over those. And it feels like snowboarding to me, just the way you could use your edges, you know, two fins on the edge. Rather than just, I mean, if you're on a thruster, you can be pivoting off your back foot in the pocket. When the waves are really good, that's a great design.
Sure.
But for around here, the four fins.
Yeah, Kelly at Margaret River, this event, talking about one of his things he doesn't like about the four fin is, like, just sticks a little too much. Like, it's good for speed, but, like, trying to get it to release, it has too much stick. So I'm wondering, with what you're talking about, where that those last two fins are smaller, you probably still benefit from a little bit of release without as much of that stickiness that he's talking about.
Yeah, I think you're right about the other four fin design where you have your power fin forward and your smaller fin trailing. You know, the power fin in the back and the smaller fin forward, it doesn't stick very much, and
you
get a lot of speed, like in the barrel too, or just gliding around sections or off the bottom. The projection, it's just incredible. I mean, there's disadvantages too, but just for the how I like to surf, those four fins are awesome.
So what was that board then? What was that last board you
had? 6'6", 2", round pin, Twinser fin setup. Thanks Joey Thomas for all these years of incredible boards. Wow.
Shout out Joe Thomas.
Yeah, JT. I'm just kind of proud of I was able to kind of just hang on to what I love doing over all these years. You know, I'm 54, and my whole life's been around surfing. I'm really passionate about surfing. I love surfing, and I was able to, you know, have a professional career surfing big waves and going to Hawaii all those years, and then my surf school where I teach a lot of people how to surf. Just it's really rewarding to share that with so many people over the years, and you know, actually make a living out of surfing too is pretty nice. You know, it's like I don't do it all for the money. I've never had the vision of doing I'm gonna make a business so I could, you know, keep surfing and still be involved. It just kind of happened naturally, and I'm pretty proud that I actually was able to pull that off in my life.
RichardSchmidt.com is the website, and we'll have a link to it as well as all the footage and photos of everything we discussed in today's show on SurfSplendorPodcast.com. Also, in regard to Santa Cruz, episode 8 of Surf Splendor focuses on Santa Cruz shapers Doug Hout, Ward Coffey, Michel Junod, and Bob Pearson. If you'd like to listen to that one, it's in the archives as well. So check out SurfSplendorPodcast.com. Follow us on social media at Surf Splendor. And just make sure to rate and review the show in iTunes or whatever app you listen in. All right, we will be back next week with an all-new episode of Surf Splendor. Until then, this is your host, David Scales, reminding you to shred on.